and welcome to Alan Carr's Easy Way podcast, where we explore all things addiction from a completely different perspective. Here at Alan Carr's Easy Way, we don't believe in using willpower to quit because we know there's a much easier and much more effective way. I'm Colleen Dwyer. I'm a senior therapist at Alan Carr's Easy Way. I'm the presenter of our series of online video programs and your podcast host. Joining me, as always, is John Dicey, the global CEO of Alan Carr's Easy Way and co-author of the Alan Carr books. With over 25 years of experience, John has a wealth of knowledge to share. John and I are answering questions from listeners, including, will stopping smoking make me tired? And is it harder to quit vaping than smoking? Also joining us today is Francesca, who has been managing Alan Carr's operations in Italy for over 20 years. Francesca knows firsthand the power of the Alan Carr method, having quit smoking herself way back in the day when Alan first started out operating in London. And since then, Francesca has been spreading the message to others through live seminars and the publishing programs in Italy. And we also have a special feature today from none other than Sir Anthony Hopkins, who is another advocate for quitting smoking with Alan Carr's Easy Way. Sir Anthony Hopkins quit smoking cigars and cigarettes with Alan's book, and he has a message for those who are also thinking about quitting nicotine addiction. And we're thrilled that he took the time to record it. So sit back, relax, and open your mind to a new way of understanding addiction. This is the Alan Carr's Easy Way podcast.
We want to air your success stories,
answer your questions,
and provide advice.
If Alan Carr's Easy Way hasn't worked for you,
this advice is free of charge.
We'll answer every question we receive with no exceptions.
Contact us now
at pod@alancarr.com.
Okay, so the first question we have is from Vanessa in Malibu Beach in California. And basically, Vanessa said that she's quitting smoking, but she caved. She stole one from her mother who lives next door. And she said, I'm going to quit again tonight. But she says that she feels when the mental spiraling is happening, the only thing to get rid of it is having a cigarette. And she said it's weird because it's not caused by the big monster, at least not in that moment. But she feels that maybe there are feelings coming up since she's quit smoking that she's like never had to deal with before, because she thought that the cigarette was somehow masking them. And now that the cigarette isn't masking them, how does she cope? And that's the general idea from Vanessa's email.
I think it's an interesting one because, of course, it is the big monster. On one hand, she says it isn't the big monster, but I think cigarettes used to help me do X, Y, and Z, repress feelings or avoid thinking about things. And of course, cigarettes did none of those things. It's her belief that they used to that's the issue. So something isn't quite right there. I would say it does sound, because I did read the whole thing before we clipped it. It does feel that that she's, Vanessa is snatching at quitting. So she keeps stopping and starting. And that's probably part of the problem, is that the method hasn't quite clicked for her. So I recommend that we send her some full-on advice on how to use the method again, this time of success. So we've done that. And within that, just cover that topic off, that, you know, smoking isn't a particularly mind-absorbing activity. It doesn't take your mind off things. It doesn't repress thoughts. And the sense people have that it does is very damaging, and it is still the big monster. If you believe it helps you, then, well, you believe you get a benefit from it. And it's quite liberating for most people when they realize that actually, you know, they've dealt with all the stresses and strains of life. They've dealt with all the, you know, terrible thoughts they've had to process or whatever else. It's them that's done it in spite of the fact they smoke rather than because they smoke. And it's a really, you know, it's a case of claiming back your own power. It's, you did it. It wasn't to do with smoking. It was everything to do with the way you process the information or decided not to process the information. And it's completely regardless of whether you smoked or not. What do you think?
Yeah, precisely. It is the big monster. And any thoughts or any influence that would make you think that smoking or vaping is a good idea is the big monster. And actually, I remember I felt really empowered when I quit smoking and I realized that all the credit that I've been giving to the cigarette for helping me cope with stress, actually, it had been me doing it all along. And not only had I been dealing with the stresses that life had presented to me, but on top of that, I was dealing with the stress of being a smoker. So I thought, well, you know, I'm pretty good at handling stress, or at least repressing it, if that's what the moment called for. So yeah, the cigarette did nothing, and it can't do those things. Like, it's just, it's not possible. And if it were possible, then goodness, you'd never have a stress smoker, you know. So yeah, Vanessa, you can take a lot of comfort from the fact that you have always handled things, you always will handle things, and you just need to follow the guidance to give stopping smoking the right, like, attention, rather than, like you say, John, just stop starting.
I think that leads on to that topic, doesn't it? Because it is something I think Vanessa was doing, was snatching at quitting. So she's quitting, failing in quick succession. And that becomes just a almost a constant state of affairs. And how do you stop that? How do you kind of draw a line under that and pause? And I think often it's best just to, you know, stop it. Just smoke as normal for a month. Carry on smoking. Don't feel guilty about it. Don't try and cut down on control smoking. Don't try to quit. Just re-engage with yourself. Life as a smoker. Set the date a month in advance and go for it on that date. I think that you know, that's, it sounds very simple, that, but obviously with the advice we give as well, it cues someone up to be able to do that as well. To break that sort of stop, start, stop thing, cycle, I think you do need that sort of 3-4 week period as a smoker again, before you brush yourself off and quit for good once and for all.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that both by saying, oh, I'll quit tomorrow, you know, I'm going to quit this afternoon or whatever, you're just denying the true nature of the trap that you're in. So by keeping that little hope alive, you're kind of telling yourself that you've got a choice. You're sort of saying to yourself, yeah, I'll smoke this morning, but, you know, I'm going to quit this afternoon. You keep kind of letting yourself off the hook.
100%. That's a key part of the addictive frame of mind as well. It's basically permission to smoke or not smoke, you know, and whenever, whether it's after a day or two, if you sense, for whatever reason, that it's not easy, that you're feeling inclined to smoke, well, there's nothing to stop you. You've done it before, you know, 100 times before, and never get off first base. And I think that's such a difficult place to get. And I think, to an extent, I was possibly like that. I mean, I was terrible at quitting. It lasted a few hours. But I wouldn't do it on a weekly basis or whatever. I think it was the other profile, is you attempt this momentous moment of stopping smoking and you last a few hours and cave in, and they think, I'm not going to do that again for a while. And you do leave it a period of time and until it builds up again and again and again. And it's sort of trying to do the same thing over and over again without success, thinking something different is going to happen. I should emphasize at that time I wasn't using Alan Carr's Easy Way, so that was the thinking behind then. I think the stop, start, stopper is something that happens to people who aren't using the method. I think it's also something that happens to people who are trying to use the method, and it can't it can't possibly pay off. You know, the stop, start, stopping. You're not reframing things. You're not going through the method again. You're not searching for a new way of looking at it, new understanding or whatever. You're just kind of thinking, okay, final cigarette, quit again. It's much, much better to get in touch with some free advice and get reset.
Okay, so well done, Vanessa. Thank you very much for getting in touch. Okay, so the next topic we're going to talk about is, should people avoid the company of other smokers or vapors after they quit doing it themselves? And that's a point that people perhaps sometimes struggle with, because the official advice perhaps would be to, yes, avoid them. Don't put yourself in a tempting situation, or don't go out drinking, or just don't put yourself under too much pressure. And really the thinking there behind it is that you want to avoid being triggered to want to smoke.
Yeah, I remember when I tried to use nicotine patches and gum. So this is way back in the 90s, early 90s or something. I remember reading the leaflet that came with them. I can't remember if it was a gum or the patches, and it had this kind of list of tips. And I think one of them, fairly early ones, was, avoid people who smoke. And I think, well, what if your partner smokes? What if you live with a smoker? Or what if you spend all day working with smokers? I mean, you're going to lose your job, lose your partner, and lose your home. It just doesn't work. Sort of counterproductive, because even if you did manage to avoid smokers, it's putting off the inevitable, isn't it? Even if you're 2-3 weeks down the line and then you go out with a bunch of people who are smokers, then you've got to get through that in exactly the same way. We assume at those times we're going to have a problem. Great thing with Easy Way, of course, is and the main reason we say get out and enjoy life right from the start is because otherwise it creates a sort of a stigma. Like, it does create a thing, a hurdle you feel you've got to jump. Whereas if you just go straight out, you realise you're free and everything's cool and hunky-dory.
So, yeah. And don't forget, you have a lot to celebrate. So why should you hide away and kind of lay low for a while? That would definitely be the willpower approach, just kind of hoping that time is going to solve your problem. And if you can go for long enough without having any nicotine, then, you know, miraculously your whole thinking will change. And that's not what happens. You just build up this fear and you say, well, I'm okay at home in my bedroom, but if I actually go out into the real world and encounter smokers, then it's going to be really tough. So yeah, and that's why it's so nice to have a completely different understanding and take on it. And then you can go out and be with smokers and love the freedom that you now have. And you can look at smokers, not in a horrible way, but you can look at them and you'll see very clearly that they're not getting any benefit from that cigarette.
Absolutely.
You're having the same conversation. You're both, you know, you're enjoying the conversation, you're enjoying the lovely setting, the great atmosphere. None of that is dependent
Absolutely.
On you having a horrible stick in your mouth. So you get to enjoy all the good stuff and you don't have to put up with any of the horrible stuff. So yeah, that would be a big fat no then to avoiding the company of other smokers, right, John? And yeah, the other thing that they wanted to talk about was, will stopping smoking make you tired?
That's a great question. And these fall into, I think we had quite a few questions along these lines from lots of people who didn't leave their names for whatever reason or whatever. This is along with, should you avoid smokers or vapors? This is probably one of the most popular ones. I don't think smokers realise, I certainly didn't when I was smoking, how tired smoking makes you. I was sort of aware of it. I was a chain smoker. And I remember waking up and just feeling okay. And as soon as I lit a cigarette, though, there was this horrible sort of feeling came over me, sort of like, you know, almost, I could almost visualise it starting at the top of my head and just draining through my body, taking all my energy away and just feeling like, ropey. And at the time, I thought that was just normal. That was just how you felt when you woke up in the morning. After a while, though, I think you do come to the conclusion, you do know, that it coincides with when you start smoking a cigarette. That's what the smoking does to you. And you feel like you get over that. But I think what I didn't realize was that's how I felt all the time. That you go through life feeling constantly tired and lethargic and run down and lacking in energy. And even though, you know, Tom has still worked really hard, played hard, did all sorts of stuff, it was definitely handicapped by this tired, constant tiredness. I mean, you were a heavy smoker as well, weren't you? Did you find the same thing?
Yeah, and a bit like you, I didn't blame the cigarettes. I thought it was just down to like the natural aging process or perhaps just my lifestyle, you know. If I've been going out and working quite full on or just other conditions that I had. So I just thought, well, like, you know, I'm asthmatic, so perhaps maybe that's got something to do with it, or maybe it's just in my genetics. I've never been, you know, one to get up and go for a run or anything like that. And so I just thought that it was an inherent trait in me. But it was only when I quit smoking, of course, that you then realized that cigarettes were the cause of it. And I actually thought, God, how did my body survive? Really? Because that's a lot of toxins that you're putting inside of your body. And I was in my late 20s when I quit, but I was already on the road to ruin, really, in terms of my energy. I'd be so tired, like even when I woke up, and that's, I guess, when you're meant to be at your most rested. And I was like waking up and dragging myself out of bed. And really, I should have been waking up and full of beans and raring to go.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It's sort of relentless, isn't it? It's a relentless bombardment. With any drug, whether it's nicotine, alcohol, or coke, or whatever it might be, it kind of completely disrupts everything natural. I was interested. I didn't realise you were asthmatic as well, because I was, and I used to carry puffers with me, and I'd be terrified of going anywhere without them. If I forgot them, I'd have to go home and get them. I literally haven't used them since I quit. It just went from being that dependent on them and having to have them on me. And that was that. It's a weirdest thing in the world. And you sort of think, yeah, I'm really badly asthmatic, but had nothing to do with the 80 cigarettes a day I was smoking, sort of thing, which is weird. And I think probably, I mean, the reason I mentioned that I was so aware of how it made me feel, it made me transition first thing in the morning from feeling, well, just sort of okay, to feeling is, I think some people don't notice this massive surge of energy when they stop. And I think that's because you feel the same as you did when you wake up. You just don't have the feeling later on. And it's sort of, you don't really remember the downside of it. It's like pain. You can't, you know, if you've broken your arm or leg or whatever, you can't remember what the pain was like. You remember it was really painful, but if you could remember what the pain was like, it would hurt. The brain would cause that pain to reoccur. And I think people just realize if getting rid of something that you're so used to, for some people, they don't even notice. They don't even realize that they've got rid of this burden.
Yeah, I mean, because maybe it was we were such heavy smokers, so it was hard to ignore, you know, like it was hard to ignore the change in the energy levels. But maybe for people who don't smoke as much, it's not quite so obvious, do you think?
Yeah, I think it seems to be. I think most smokers that I've met, and even vapors, all maintain how much more energy they felt they had when they quit. I think it's the occasional one that doesn't notice, and I think the explanation, I think we explained pretty why that might be. The question was also, would stopping smoking or vaping make you tired? I think that was also part of the question, which is weird. I think if you use willpower to stop, definitely. I think most people understand that if you try and battle your way to quitting smoking or vaping using willpower, you sort of hang on for grim life. And it really is exhausting and exasperating and frustrating and stressful. And that all is enough to tire anybody out. So as long as you use easy way, as long as you find it easy, then it is quite the reverse. You feel liberated and free and full of beans and what have you. The prospect of is vaping more difficult to quit than smoking? It's a good question. I think in a similar way, you know, methadone can help heroin addicts get free from heroin. Not many people realize that it's actually harder to get off methadone than it is to get off heroin, which is one of those sort of ironies that of the methadone-led cessation programs for heroin. And vapors, more and more so recently, have been describing how unpleasant they found vaping, which isn't something that was in the brochure, if that makes sense. Everyone says, you know, medical profession in certain countries, you know, vaping is much less harmful than smoking, which I suppose is true to an extent. We're still waiting for data on that, really, as the vaping market develops and gains longevity. The mid to long term effects of vaping certainly seem to be growing. You know, stuff we're seeing in seminars, people we're talking to on social media are describing, you know, a very similar experience to smoking. How in terms of how it makes them feel tired, lethargic, controlled, and not well. Generally not well. And I think there are several reasons for that. Obviously, you're still poisoning your body. But I also think that lots of smokers and vapors use both. So some people will smoke when they can and vape when they can't. So they're actually taking in more nicotine than they had done before. Likewise, even those that exclusively vape, because they can do it anywhere and any time, any place, they're addicted to nicotine, so they do. So there's this natural tendency, and again, anecdotally, I've met quite a few people like this who just say they, even people who have never smoked, will say they end up completely hooked on their vape, whether it's a disposable or a tank or whatever it is. And it can be almost constant. They can do it in the car, they can do it at home when the kids are asleep, they can do it, you know, there's no going outside for it or whatever. And certainly on lots of devices, you can regulate the amount of nicotine you get. And I think the natural tendency for any addict is to eventually nudge that up to, you know, the maximum. It's all, you know, it's almost inevitable. And lots of disposables, things like Elf bars, whatever the latest version is, they contain sort of something like 40 to 50 cigarettes worth of nicotine in that one device, which is disposable, because people tend to puff away on them whenever there's sort of a spare moment. And it's not like a cigarette you light and then smoke it for a while and stub it out. It's 45 cigarettes long, if that makes sense, in one way. And more people who found themselves once they went on to disposables, going through one a day. You know, it's a lot of nicotine. And I think it does worry me that the health authorities, who are so invested in vaping being the way forward for smokers, won't ever take it into account. They won't take into account the tendency for any addict, every addict, to get more of the drug. They always want more. They never decide to have less. It's a progressive thing. And who knows what the consequences of that are. I think we have to say we're kind of obliged to say, being in the UK, that government advice is to, you know, if you can't stop, switch to vaping, as it's seen as less harmful than smoking, which is say, you know, probably true. But no one knows in the medium to short term. And the whole point is really, what's what we say is, why would you switch to vaping when it's just as easy to stop? Easier to stop. And it's getting expensive now, I think, vaping. I think disposables in the UK certainly are costing sort of £5 or £6 per device. What's that, $6 or $7, something like that. And that adds up. It's sort of only just about half the price of cigarettes, I suppose, isn't it, at the moment? And the prices will only go up. So I think some people, for a whole variety of reasons, do find it harder to quit vaping than they might have done to quit smoking, because of some of the stuff we've talked about, that they can do it anytime, any place, anywhere. There's no obstacles that stand in the way of vaping. Don't have to leave the house to do it. Don't have to leave that quite a lot of the time. Don't have to leave the office to do it more and more. So with Easy Way, we found that over the course of many years since vaping has been around, that the vapers find it equally easy to stop as smokers. And that's the really good news. So in our live seminars, the same seminar works for smokers or vapers, or people who do both. Even for someone who has never smoked, the Stop Smoking, Stop Vaping seminar will still work for them. We also have the book and online video program for those who have never smoked. If they want to literally just relate everything to vaping, then Path to Freedom for them is easy as well. So yeah, technically, for a variety of reasons, vaping can be harder to quit than smoking if you're using willpower, but equally easy if you're using Easy Way.
Yeah, that's so true. And I guess I was thinking, like, with smoking, there are so many different solutions being presented to smokers, albeit that they're not successful. But, you know, there are nicotine replacement therapies like the patches and the gum and the vapes. And also there's Zyban and hypnotherapy and acupuncture, whereas the market for quitting vaping is a lot younger. So there's not many as many solutions being put before the vapor. And I also wonder whether vapers are a bit like casual smokers, in that they think, well, you know, I'm not as bad as so-and-so who's having an actual cigarette. And so the vapor is less incentivized to actually address their issues. And even if their loved ones are saying, you know, come on, please quit, in the vapor's mind, they're thinking, well, come on, I've done this. I've gone from cigarettes to vapes. What more do you want, you know? So although maybe the slavery is awful and the damaging and negative effects, like you say, and who knows what the long-term, mid-term effects of vaping will be shown to be. But in the vapor's mind, they're just like, well, by comparison to smoking, is it really that bad? You know, and it's so easy to do. And it looks like this innocuous thing. It's not like these elf bars and these geek bars. They don't look out of place in a pencil case or a makeup case. You know, they're very nicely designed, so they just look innocent.
I think psychologically, people who switch to vaping might find it harder, purely because of exactly what you've just said. Sort of elsewhere in the world, a smoker who switches to vaping automatically will sense, okay, this is not as bad as smoking, so that's kind of okay. In the UK, they've been pretty much brainwashed into thinking along terms of it's almost harmless. You know, going back 10 years, the people responsible for vaping becoming a smoking cessation tool, we described it as no more, you know, no more worrying than someone having a cup of coffee. You know, they didn't relate it to someone having 50 cups of coffee a day, which is the nature of nicotine addiction. So there is that, and part of what we do, whether it's in the book or in my video program or the live seminars, is kind of undo that brainwashing. I mean, for starters, all smokers are worried about their health. They might deny it. They might close their mind from it, but they are. But it's the health concerns don't help us quit. In fact, they make it sort of harder to quit. We get scared in sight of a cigarette. So all this stuff sort of unravels during the seminar. And the fact that vaping might be less harmful than smoking, it's neither here nor there, really. The fact is, it's the control, the slavery, the self-esteem, you know, feeling daft, sort of sucking on this weird-looking thing. And once those are all taken into account, it is easy. It's just that kind of sense that they have a get-out-jail-free card that might get in their minds, and the method pulls them away from that.
Thanks very much, John, for answering those questions. And now it's time for Sir Anthony Hopkins. He is one of the most celebrated actors of our time and a true legend in the entertainment industry. He has won numerous awards, including an Academy Award, 2 Emmys, and a BAFTA. He has generously given his time to record a message for us all. So let's get to it. Here is Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Hello, I'm Anthony Hopkins. You will know already that Alan Carr is widely considered to be the world's leading expert on stopping smoking. Now, I myself stopped smoking some years ago, but I had often been tempted to smoke the occasional harmless cigar or the occasional harmless cigarette. Anyway, some friends of mine who had stopped smoking using Alan's method suggested I read his book, and I did. It was such a revelation that instantly I was freed from my addiction. Like those friends of mine, I found it not only easy, but unbelievably enjoyable to stay stopped. As a result, I feel healthier and happier. Now, I don't pretend to understand what it is that Alan Carr says that makes it so easy. But if you have already seen the video or read the book, and are still smoking, it means, quite simply, that you have misunderstood. And that's all. Just imagine being trapped in a complicated maze for most of your life. Well, Alan Carr has a plan to that maze. It's as if he is saying, you take a left turn here, now a right turn, now another left, and so on. But if you ignore one of the instructions, there is simply no point in following the rest of them. You will still be trapped in that maze. But don't forget, when you do stop smoking, you are doing something quite wonderful for yourself and something quite wonderful for your life. And you will feel great to think that you are stopping. So, here's wishing you luck.
Addiction Central. Addiction Central. We want to air your success stories,
answer your questions,
and provide advice.
If Alan Carr is what hasn't worked for you,
this advice is free of charge.
We'll answer every question we receive with no exceptions.
Contact us now
at pod@alancarr.com.
Hello, I am Francesca Cesati. I am the person responsible of the Alan Carr Easy Way in Italy. And I'm also a therapist of Alan Carr and the editor of Alan Carr's books in Italian.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today, Francesca. I was just going to get stuck in straight away. And how old were you when you first started smoking, and what kind of a smoker were you?
All right. First of all, thank you for inviting me to this recording. I was very, very young. Obviously, I will never tell how old I am, but very, very young. I remember also it was a very odd experience thinking back, because the first puff was given to me by the mother of a girlfriend of mine where I used to go and play. She was convinced a cigarette helped her digest. So I remember one afternoon I went to play with this girlfriend of mine and had my first puff, which now sounds terrible, I mean, to be denounced to the police, this lady. But at the time, obviously, it was, I'm not saying normal, but so that was my first experience. And I'm pretty sure probably helped my digestive system, because probably I felt sick. But from that path, I remember I used to go and play with this girl more often. So it became a puff a week and so on. And obviously, my parents didn't know anything, because otherwise they would have barricaded me in the house and so on. I grew up in a family where there were four people. I lived with my grandparents as well. And the two men, I, my dad and my grandfather, smoked, while my grandmother and my mother never smoked. So smoking was fairly accepted. Also, that was a time where more or less 90% of the male population smoked. But obviously, my dad was absolutely contrary to me smoking. So then I went to senior school, and that original path became a small packet share with my classmates. Slowly, I climbed up to 20 cigarettes a day. And then I remember after 22 years of smoking, I had reached 40, 45 cigarettes a day. So I was a serious smoker. But going back to my young days, I had a particular memory of my grandfather. Because I am an only child, obviously my grandfather was my dear friend. He was the one who taught me to read. He was the one who taught me to read the hands on the grandfather clock. He used to take me to music lesson. So I was really, really very fond of him. But if I think back, I realize that I never seen him without a cigarette, either in his mouth or in his hand. And I also do remember, I have this very clearly in my mind, I never seen him stubbing out a cigarette, but rather he flicked the lit ember from the tip of the cigarette with his thumb and put what remained of his cigarette. Bear in mind, at the time, most cigarettes were without filters. So he just stick what remained of the cigarette in his pocket. And once home, he would empty the pockets and put those butts in a little metal box. And he would use those crumbled to make himself a new cigarette. Obviously, this was something he had learned during the war, when everything was ration. So there were cards that established how much flour, how much coffee, how much tobacco you could have. And there were people starving, and I'm pretty sure the same situation repeats itself today in a situation of war. People that give perhaps a piece of food to have some tobacco. But because, and I remember hearing that this was happening also in concentration camp, people would just give the last spoonful of soup to be able to have a couple of puff. But because the tobacco was never enough, people used to just pick what was left of cigarette from the pavement. And so it was my granddad who spoke to me about this, and he used to call this tobacco the pavement cat. And this was a sort of activity which I picked up, I went back to in my later years as a smoker, because I fundamentally think that there are two kinds of smoker. The one that can't bear the idea of being without cigarette. They have cigarette everywhere, under the pillow, in the fridge. So the whole idea of remaining without cigarette make them get into a state of panic. And they go to their graves with a cigarette pack. So if ever the judgment day were to come, they would have one problem they wouldn't have to worry about, to be without cigarette. So they have cigarette everywhere. And then there is the other group, the minimalist, and I belong to that one. Going in and out from England to Italy and so on, I despite that, I never actually bought a carton of cigarettes, because I was always convinced that I was on the verge of quitting. And so seeing all the carton would just bring home the idea that it was a terrible waste of money. However, this did not stop me to popping out to the newsagent four times a day to buy a packet of 10 each time, and hoping that that might be that my way back, might be the road to Damascus, and that I would see the light and suddenly stop smoking. But never happened. But these led to situation in which I would remain without cigarette. And I remember parties with friends that they go away at 2 o'clock at night, and I tidy up and said, oh my God, I am without cigarette. So I would explore the packets that were left. And it's very, very rare that people leave cigarette behind. They leave the umbrella if it's raining, the coat, if it's cold, but they never forget cigarettes. So then I would just inspect ashtrays. And if I were to find half a cigarette smoke, I would just thank God. And then the person who had smoked it could have, I don't know, typhoid, cholera, what it didn't matter. It was a gift. And if everybody had actually smoked everything, then I would go back to the famous pavement cats. I would just get five or six cigarettes and then crumble what was left against the filter in one sheet of toilet paper, because in my imagination, that was the nearest to the cigarette paper. And then you have to be the Clint Eastwood first version, because toilet paper does, and there's absolutely nothing left. So a couple of puffs, 2 o'clock at night, and then I went to sleep. So I was a serious smoker, I suppose. Yes, I think I was.
Yeah, you sound like you were a serious smoker, but you still kept alive the hope that you were on the verge of quitting. Why do you think that was?
Continuously.
What made you want to quit? Why did you start thinking like that?
Because every winter I had bronchitis, because I was spending a fortune, and I could feel that wasn't good for me. And I tried everything. I tried some herb cigarettes they were selling at the chemist. I tried some spray that fundamentally blocked your mouth. If you have stuck a cigarette in it, you just was unable to speak. It was a horrible thing. I tried acupuncture. I tried hypnosis in London. So there was this pathetic attempt. And I smoked in pregnancy. I love to think there were 5 a days. I'm not proud of it. Probably there were 10 a day. Smoked half of the time. And then sticking half a tube of toothpaste in my mouth, because obviously the official version was the fact that I wasn't smoking anymore. So despising myself profoundly. And feeling terribly guilty. And then something happened. I bought 6 chairs from an antique shop, and I decided that I would just mend them, because the seat was completely gone. So I enrolled myself at an upholstery course in Twickenham. And I used to go to lesson, and every now and again, I used to pop out to have a cigarette. And when I came back one day, a lady said, would you like to stop smoking? I said, oh, yes, of course, but. And she said, well, my husband, who was a chimney, had gone to a gentleman and chatted for an afternoon. And he's now 3 months since he doesn't smoke. And I can't imagine how happy he is. So I looked at her and I said, well, I did try hypnosis and blah, blah, blah. And so she said, no, it's not hypnosis, just a chat. And also, if I don't remember wrongly, if you don't manage to stop, they will give you your money, I guarantee. Ta-da! Obviously, she made an offer I couldn't refuse. So it took me a few weeks to decide to make this phone call. And then I arrived in Rains Park and rang with trembling finger that bell. And a dark haired lady came to open the door. Now, I know it's Joyce, is Alan Carr's wife. And then she took me to a room where there were other people writing, filling a questionnaire. And this room was full of books and letters. And at one point I glimpsed to some of them, and they were all, thank you, I will be grateful to you for the rest of my life. I owe you my life. You should be made a saint. And I was thinking, my God, Mr. Carr and Mrs. Carr are spending the night writing these things and scattering in the flats. And I said, well, they are quite good, because the handwriting looks pretty different. Obviously, my first thought was this. Anyway, then I was taken into another room, and there was a gentleman next to a pile of cigarettes. You could hardly see him, because in that room everybody was smoking whilst he was talking. 5 hours later, I came out from that house fairly surprised and sort of in a peculiar state of mind, because half of me was saying, you stop smoking. And the other half said, no, obviously not. And this dialogue went on for months. I would just wake up in the morning and say, I am a non-smoker. And the other would say, no, just wait. And then I had to admit I had stopped smoking. And it was, I suppose, the equivalent of being illuminated for a Buddhist or whatever to reach Nirvana. And fundamentally, it was incredibly easy. And whenever I saw people smoking, I would just really say, go to see this gentleman, because immediately it triggers out your saving the world attitude. I asked Alan at the time if he was doing something in Italy when I came out from the seminar. And he said, no, I'm too busy here, because I could see that there were already books in German and so on. Obviously, it was an incredible experience. And still now, I've been doing seminars and working in Italy for the Alan Carr for 25 years now. But still, I haven't lost the enthusiasm. And if anything, it's growing. Is growing. Yeah.
So what happened? How did you come to be the franchisee then for Italy?
I had come to live in England in 1978. The idea was to stay there for 6 months. 20 years later, I was still there. But in a way, I wanted to, come back more often to Italy. And also, nobody knew about the method here, and being Italy a great smoking country, I thought perhaps I should take the good news to my fellow citizens. So I got in touch with Alan, and he had started, having franchisee around Europe. And so originally I started with Milan. I only had the franchise for Milan. And then it became the whole of Italy. And I remember that for about 10 years, I did this very peculiar life, because my son at the time was 10 and he was at school there. And I was working in Italy. So I used to do London, Milan, Rome, Florence, because by word of mouth, people were saying, there is a group of people that want to stop in this place and so on. So I come back to see I call it the book of my life, which was the first record of my seminars of the time. And I used to do first seminar in the afternoon, second and third in the morning, and then leave, and then the following day go in another city and do another seminar in the afternoon. And I really don't know how I did it, because obviously I had to come back because my son was at school. So I used to spend, say, 1 week around and then back again. But I managed.
And you published a book, did you, as well, in Italy, Francesca?
Well, yes, because the book was originally published by a very big Italian editor, Spelling and Cooper. But like every big publishing house, it was just a number in a catalogue. So when I started doing the seminar here, I contacted them and I said, you should republish it because it's doing very well around Europe. Oh, yes, perhaps. I offered to do the seminar to the employees to show that the method was working. Perhaps. Have a look at the translation. Perhaps. Fax, silence. And at one point, the rights went back to Alan Carr. And somebody said, well, why don't you publish it? Me, already I was leading this ridiculous life, going up and down from plane and so on. And I said, but I don't know anything about publishing. Oh, it's nothing. It's nothing. You redo the translation, and then we will print it in England, ship it over, and blah, blah, blah. And so I did on a plane and on trains. I retranslated the book, and then it was published in December 2003. So this year will be the 20th year of his existence in Italian. And I remember that at the beginning, I didn't have a distributor. So we used to send books out from the post office because obviously it was fairly famous in other countries. So the brothers, the cousins used to just ring the person in Italy, say, oh, you should read this book and so on. So we received requests and we would go to the post office and send it. So first print was 3,000 copies, then 5,000 copies. And then I said, oh, God, I can't carry on this life. I have to find a distributor. So rang a couple of them, but they would ask, how many books have you got in your catalog? And I said, actually, just one. But he's selling very well. And I said, no, we are not interested. And so I think spring 2004, I managed to get to this distributor who is called Ali and met this gentleman. And so we went to the office and I said, you take this book because this is the, how do you say it in English? The hen with the golden egg or the golden goose, the goose with the golden eggs. Yeah, something like that. And he said, okay, let's try. And now the book has been in print, as I said to you, for 20 years, and has sold 1,680,000 copies. So not bad, not bad.
Yeah, wow. That is very impressive, Francesca. And all those people that have been saved from your efforts.
Well, the efforts of the book is I've done I haven't translated in English, but there is a little introduction at the book in which fundamentally he says, I'm just a book, I can't even read, but I know that when people read me, they are happy and then they suggest me to other people. It hasn't been easy. I was born in December as well. It reminds me of other stories. And fundamentally, I was born in a post office. Now I am 20. And I got 40 brothers who are much older than me. For example, the English one was born in 1985 and blah, blah, blah. And then there is the Russian and the German and so on. We are a big family, but we are all very proud of what we do. So this is the book talking.
I love that. And so what's it been like then bringing the message to smokers in Italy and vapors, I guess, now as well?
Yeah. It's very hard, obviously, because we know the mentality we had when we smoked is not the right moment. Now with the electronic cigarette and the IQOS and the Juul and so on, there is the limitation of damage, which is absolute distorted and mad philosophy, because one starts from the assumption that one has to damage itself, but it's not true. We don't need to damage ourselves. So it's been very gratifying because you know that you can really change people's lives in few hours. And we have plenty of testimonials from people who have bought the books or came to the seminar. And I did a seminar in Rome a couple of weeks ago. And there was a chap who had come to the seminar 15 years ago. And he stayed 15 years without smoking, very enthusiastic, and then did the silly thing of. And at the end of the seminar, he said, I will always be incredibly grateful to you and to the method. And what is amazing, you have exactly the same enthusiasm that you had 15 years ago. And it's true. Every time there are new people that you have to help out of the the hole in which they've fallen. And then you know that once they see the trick of the smoking, they are much more capable of seeing all the various other tricks that the society in which we live, the culture in which we live, play on us. And so for these, is a very gratifying work. And I will always be incredibly grateful to Alan for that chat that afternoon, 35 years ago, 35 years ago.
So it's 40 years since Alan discovered the method, 35 years since you quit with the program, and 20 years since the book has been, since you published the book in Italy.
Yeah. And 25 years that I do this work.
Is the method applied to other things in Italy?
Right. We have the webcast for the alcohol. We have the books on flying, the weight. So we do most of the book of Alan Carr. They are available. In terms of seminar.
Do you know what percentage of people smoke now and vape in Italy?
Right, yes. The figure had been going down until the COVID. And then COVID, last 2 years, there has been an increase of 1 million people coming back to smoke or starting smoking. And the e-cigarette had an increase of from 2017 to 2021 of 750%.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, and I might have made this up in my own head, but I had it in my mind that you were the inspiration for Alan to write the Fear of Flying book. Was that right? I decided
that. It could be. It could be, because I was petrified of flying, absolutely petrified. I remember dragging the poor soul of my son between London and to Milan. And it took us, it was a sort of, I saw Rob Roy last night. It was more or less the traveling of that time, 2 days to go from London to Milan, because I got the train and then the overcraft and then slept in Paris, taking another train and so on. But I was petrified of flying, petrified. And I mentioned that to Alan, and Alan said, well, I don't like it as well, but I'm writing a book, and so I think I have it somewhere. And he called me the Red Baron at one point, like, you know, the hero of the flying of the First World War. And I must say, once he sent me the draft, it did actually help quite a lot. And then my following time as a therapist, a moving therapist, I did it flying. There was no other way to do it. And I was fairly relaxed. Now I catch the plane and I'm fairly relaxed.
Yeah. Oh, that's good.
Yeah.
It was great how Alan could apply his... you know, the logic to the fear of flying as well, wasn't it?
Absolutely, absolutely. But you can apply his logic to every aspect of life, really. I remember one lady, 15 years ago, sent us an email and said, I'm nomad. And when somebody started saying, I'm nomad, you have to be very prepared. They might be slightly mad, but anyway... she said, I read the book and I've stopped smoking 6 months ago and I'm incredibly happy. Well, I have a bad relationship with a gentleman for quite a long time. If I were to reread the book, putting instead of the word cigarette, I put the name of this gentleman, do you think I will be able to get rid of him as well? And I remember... I was in Sardinia because I was going to do a seminar in a corporate company nearby, a petrol company. And I was sitting in a garden of the hotel. And it took me about an afternoon, but I wrote a mail saying, yes, I think you can.
Aww. I wonder if, if she's free.
I never heard from her, but... I suppose because, again, it doesn't work for fear, but it works on what do I get out of this? Yes. And if you get out on the nasty things, then why do you do it?
Yeah, quite.
And the fear goes.
There's a lot of parallels between smoking and maybe a bad relationship, aren't there? Because, you know, it's like it undermines you, it knocks your confidence.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And makes you feel like you need it. You're dependent on it for your courage and your confidence and your ability to handle stress. And so, yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you are petrified to lose what you in reality doesn't exist. Because really is all a figment of your imagination. And you're perfectly capable of living without this enormous stone that you drag around thinking that it gives you courage and God knows what. But it's a key to many, many doors that lead to freedom.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's been 35 years for you since your last cigarette. What do you think would have happened, Francesca, if you hadn't have quit smoking?
I wouldn't be here. I wouldn't be here. Because, as I said to you, I smoked everywhere. There was a time where my dad was, I think it's the introduction of the book. I used to go and visit my parents and my mother would start behaving like a traffic warden. So, carry on like this, carry on like this, you will end like him. And like him was my dad sitting at the table next to a gigantic cylinder of oxygen destroyed by emphysema and chronic bronchitis. And I would look at my dad, but obviously I wasn't seeing him because 2 minutes later I was in the bath with the window open smoking. So I smoked, as I said to you, when I was expecting my child. I smoked in hospitals. I smoked everywhere. So I don't think I would be sitting here talking to you if I carried on. If I didn't buy those chairs and if I didn't meet that lady and if I blah, 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 blah. Yes.
It's funny how life works out, isn't it? But I'm so pleased you did buy those chairs, Francesca.
I'm sitting still on them. They are still in. They are in Milan. Yeah. They are still here, and I looked at them and say,
the upholstery has stood the test of time.
Absolutely.
Good job. Thank you so much for today, Francesca. Thank you for all the work you do in Italy. And that brings us to the end of our podcast. I hope you enjoyed listening to the insights shared by Francesca and Sir Anthony Hopkins and the Addiction Central segment led by John Dicey. I also want to thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. Your support and engagement means the world to us. And I really hope you found today's podcast informative and entertaining. If you did enjoy the podcast, we'd love it if you could take a moment to like, subscribe and review. It helps us to reach even more people who can benefit from the content that we provide. So we'll be back again soon with more thought-provoking questions from our listeners and guests. Until then.